Hey everyone, and welcome to Risky Business, your weekly information security news and current affairs show. My name's Patrick Gray. Adam and I have just returned from Black Hat and DEF CON in Las Vegas. And in this week's show, we're just going to have a look at the InfoSec news we missed over the last couple of weeks. We did plan to recap Black Hat in this podcast, but we wound up a little bit short on space. So I'm busting that out into a separate podcast that I'll push live sometime around Monday. So this podcast will just be a discussion around news plus a sponsor interview. And this week's show is sponsored by BugCrowd. Big thanks to them. BugCrowd CTO Casey Ellis will join us this week to talk about a few things. Firstly, how some research presented at Black Hat by the team at PortSwigger is kind of a sign that serious research teams are using bounties to monetize serious business security research. Then we'll be talking about the BugCrowd University Initiative and a reboot of the Disclose.io project. That is coming up soon, but of course, it is time to get into the news now with Adam Boileau of Insomnia Security. And mate, we're going to start with some news from Australia. The federal government here has unveiled its so-called Assistance and Access Bill. This is, of course, the bill that stupid people said would outlaw encryption. I'm still getting a grip on the draft, but so far it actually looks pretty sensible.
Yes, the proposed legislation includes, you know, the sorts of thing you'd expect from modern, you know, modern approach towards lawful intercept of, you know, services that are more complicated than you could just pick up off the wire. So heading towards messaging services and service providers, you know, like Facebook and Twitter and all that kind of thing. It includes, you know, a bunch of mechanisms for the government to go and ask for assistance from technology companies to, you know, intercept communications or gain access to stored communications. But it has a whole load of, you know, quite sensible sounding safeguards, you know, for example, you know, that there won't be a requirement for companies to, you know, introduce widespread backdoors or weaken encryption or, you know, introduce the sorts of things that, you know, the when we were having the Apple versus FBI debate earlier on in the year, you know, that would result in weakening of the entire ecosystem, you know, just to solve, you know, to deal with one particular case or one particular warrant. So, yeah, it seems like, you know, a good mix of, you know, meeting everybody's concerns whilst also heading towards a place where, you know, the government might be able to claw back some, you know, ability to intercept technical communications.
Yeah, and the precise language there is that communications providers must not be required to implement or build a systemic weakness in their services. So, you know, and they say that's a provision written after months of consultation with the technology sector. Really, it's a few sentences written just to neutralize a dumb argument that was always dumb, which is this idea that somehow the Australian government was going to mandate everyone used, you know, DES encryption or something. You know, like this was never going to happen. But it seems like there's, you know, three levels of assistance that they're going to be requiring of communications and software companies. One is a technical assistance request, which is, you know, allows for providers to voluntarily help. There's a technical assistance notice, which can be issued by the intercepting agency to require a communications provider to offer assistance. And then there's a technical capability notice, which can be issued by the Attorney General. And the idea there is they might be asking for them to, you know, actually build some sort of capability to be used against a specific target, you know, without weakening the broader ecosystem and whatever. But it all seems couched in terms of what's reasonably possible. And there's a lot of language about, you know, how all of these things need to be reasonable and proportional and whatnot. So, you know, I mean, I get the feeling that if there is something being asked that a company feels is too much, I mean, they might be able to litigate that. So it does seem on the surface of it that it's quite a sensible law. That said, I mean, because everyone's been banging on about how, you know, the Australian government doesn't understand encryption and how they want to ban maths and all of that dumb stuff that I've been calling dumb stuff for several months on the show, we've sort of missed the bigger debate. And one of the concerns I have about this is, you know, these notices can be used against companies when we're talking about offences that only carry like 3 years in prison. Our threshold here for telecommunications warrants used to be 7 years. They got lowered some years ago to 3 so that they could catch some white-collar crimes and corruption. But, you know, surely, I thought personally that maybe the solution to that problem would be to increase the sentences for corruption, given that it's a serious offence. But, you know, this is where we are. And because we've been having the dumb debate, we haven't been able to have the sensible one.
Yeah, well, this of course is the, you know, as you say, is the challenge that we have when we argue about 90s cypherpunk rather than, you know, pragmatism, I suppose.
I just get the feeling that if these powers were reserved for, you know, plainly a short list of the most serious crime types, that, you know, they're likely to get more traction with the technology firms as well as the voting public. That's just my feeling. But look, let's move on. We've got some more processor bugs. This time, Intel SGX looking a little bit creaky. I'm not fully au fait with what's going on this one, Adam. Have you had a chance to look at it?
Yeah, so this is a bug with Intel's SGX platform, which is a kind of a component of x86 architecture that lets you, you know, kind of create secure enclaves. So it's meant to be an area of the CPU where you can protect, you know, memory and instructions, you know, in terms of confidentiality and integrity, you know, from privileged processes, from kernel space even. And yeah, this is a set of kind of Spectre and Meltdown style speculative execution bugs against code running inside an SGX defined enclave. In this case, they've got some demonstrations to, you know, say leak key material being processed inside an enclave on behalf of some other process, which, you know, it's a sort of a niche use case, but the SGX part of the
I don't know, man. Not in cloud environments, you know.
Well, like, I guess this is where I was heading. Like, in the cases where you do have, you know, code running in a hypervisor, code running in a kernel, you know, cloud environments are really one of the ones that come to mind. Then, yeah, that may well actually be a vector that is important. And in fact, the patches that we're seeing already for this issue, which primarily revolve around the level one cache in the CPU, and basically Intel's released some microcode updates that will flush the level one cache to try and get rid of the side effects of the speculative execution that was misspeculated. That, of course, doesn't help when you're running on the same core. So if you're in a hyper-threaded environment, in a cloud environment, even the current fixes may not actually be adequate. So, yeah, in those environments where people were relying on an enclave. And that's one of the bits where I'm not super clear how much SGX is actually used.
I mean, I saw something kicking around about how, like, some of the major, like, you know, cloud compute firms have actually been using it and sort of investing pretty heavily in it, right? So I think this is something that you might just go, oh, well, who's actually using it? I think the answer is actually quite a few.
Yeah, I mean, I had a quick rummage around. There's some examples of even things as simple as, you know, like certificate management in SSL libraries using it to protect key material and that kind of thing, as well as obviously more, you know, more useful things, you know, in use in cloud vendors and people who are, you know, doing like cloud HSMs and stuff like that. The kind of technology you'd imagine them using. What we have also seen is that the same plumbing is in use, or at least to some relationship with SMM mode, which is kind of like the hardware system management mode on x86. That you could perhaps attack in the same way. So certainly the impact is not small. I'm just not 100% clear, you know, what it means.
We've just had a huge run of these sort of things, and I think we just, you know, maybe need to start rethinking how much separation we get between processors on the same silicon. You know, like, is that a realistically achievable thing?
You know, and certainly that is one of the key recommendations that we saw, you know, back with Spectre and Meltdown and for this as well, which is, you know, if you've got VMs that are implementing security critical stuff, pin them to a specific CPU core, turn off hyper-threading, you know, try and isolate at least at that level so that the microarchitectural quirks are not shared across security domains. Of course, yeah, in the more general sense, not running stuff that you want good segregation of on the same hypervisor does seem like pretty good advice. You know, hardware segregation still has its day, clearly.
Now, we've spoken a fair bit this year about how NotPetya was, you know, the most expensive security incident in history. Looks like WannaCry is, you know, hot on the heels, coming up number two position. apparently, this company, Taiwan Semiconductor Manufacturing, you know, they're looking at, like, losing $256 million in sales because their internal network got WannaCried. They are, of course, a supplier to Apple of, you know, iPhone parts. So, you know, this is just amazing, isn't it, that we've just seen these crappy worms just cause billions upon billions of dollars worth of damage?
Yeah, no, this is pretty terrifying in a way. And TSMC are not a small operation. That's one of the, you know, world's major chip fabricators. And yeah, them getting WannaCried on their manufacturing network, like their actual chip fabrication systems, according to the stories. Like, it's not just like back office stuff. This is actual manufacturing. 80% of their manufacturing offline is not good. And yeah, Apple, of course, is one of their big customers, and Apple, of course, has some product deadlines to ship pretty soon with new iPhones and that kind of thing coming out. So yeah, that's yeah, they were saying, what, $256 million worth of revenue hit as a result of, you know, of WannaCry, which, you know, really is one of the least successful of the worms that we've seen around using the, you know, the Eternal Blue exploits. There's some speculation that maybe TSMC had done enough egress filtering on their manufacturing network such that WannaCry couldn't actually connect out to the, you know, the Marcus Hutchins Kilbit DNS.
Yeah, right. Service. Nice, and, nice work on your egress filtering there, guys. Yeah, that would explain it. I mean, that was going to be my question, right? Which is why didn't it get dropped?
Well, yeah, I guess best practice egress filtering. Pity about the not so best practice Windows XP.
You wonder how bad it would have been without that kill switch, right? Like, you know. And I do sort of think, like, you know, as much as we're like, oh, you know, like the NSA is going to have exploits and stuff. You do sort of think, once we've tallied the cost from this one, that maybe hanging on to SMB bugs might have been a bit of a miscalculation.
Yeah, well, you'd hope that the you know, the equities process might take into account.
might cop a bit of an update, right?
Yeah, like $1 billion worth of downstream damage when it gets nicked 10 years later, you know, might be a thing that's worth considering versus, you know, popping a couple of terrorists.
Now, look, speaking of these sort of risk assessments, Motherboard, I think it was Joe Cox at Motherboard, actually FOI'd a bunch of documents from the US military looking at how Cyber Command planned an op against Islamic State. And, you know, there's some interesting stuff here. I mean, you know, we've had details on this op have been public before, but actually getting the nitty gritty out of these documents and slides, it's cool stuff.
Yeah, so some of the documents that they obtain kind of go through the process by which they assess, you know, the considerations for, you know, actually going ahead and doing the cyber to someone. You know, the sorts of whether or not they're going to get attributed to, what kind of fallout there's going to be, what would happen if they get snapped whilst they're doing it, you know, the risks of the tools and the techniques and all that kind of thing, which I think is, you know, certainly no surprise for anyone who's worked inside, you know, the intel or the military community, you know, that there are a lot of forms to fill out. But I mean, so like in the context of those Eternal exploits leaking, it's kind of good to consider that, you know, it's good that they considered the impact of doing these kinds of operations. But perhaps, yeah, I'm not sure whether you can expect anyone to kind of predict what the massive downstream impact could be, you know, kind of a low probability, high impact kind of thing.
But well, yeah, I guess that's what the anti-exploit brigade are always banging on about. And it's like, you know, it's I have to admit they have a point now, you know, where I've been previously I've been pretty critical of them and just saying, bah, but now you're like, well, yeah, maybe they have a point.
Yeah, I mean, obviously they've done a lot of operations over the years that haven't ended in things going horribly wrong, but we do have a few now, you know, a few examples of things which have gone really quite horribly wrong for them. But, yeah, it's good to see that, you know, Motherboard went through that process and, you know, got some of these docs out, because it does kind of, you know, give us an insight, you know, for those of us that are on the outside of those bits of the world, you know, quite how much work it is to be a hacker, you know, doing the actual cyber for, you know, for government agencies. So much paperwork.
Now, of course, Adam, we didn't run a show last week because you and I were both in the United States running around like headless chickens through a desert hellscape. But yeah, there was this breach at Reddit, which apparently involved like, you know, bypass of SMS-based 2FA. You'd assume through like SIM porting. But the funny thing is, like, they haven't said.
Yeah, it is kind of strange. When someone compromised, you know, Reddit admin's password, use that to get into some particular system that had some backup, some stuff, and yeah, they say it said it had SMS two-factor auth. That SMS auth was bypassed, and there's no real specifics about that mechanism. And obviously, people have speculated, you know, that it was SS7 jacking, or speculated that it was number porting, you know, SIM swap fraud, or it could have been something else. You know, that iOS feature where it'll like push text messages to your Mac across the local network. You know, if someone's shelled your local device, maybe they can get the SMS via that. But yeah, we don't really know. The impact of this particular intrusion was, though, that there was a backup of Reddit's database from when they launched in 2005, kicking around on the box, and that had, like, you know, private messages and user passwords and all sorts of things covering a 2-year period, which is really not a particularly great look. I'm sure a few people have the same creds on Reddit, or in fact had embarrassing conversations via Reddit PM
People having embarrassing conversations on the internet, that would never happen.
Shocking, I know, right?
look, speaking of SIM swap fraud and, you know, SMS-based stuff, we've spoken about some of these attacks against, you know, cryptocurrency exchanges involving SIM swaps. Someone who lost $23 million is now suing AT&T because they ported over his number twice. And, you know, this is one to watch. I mean, I don't think... I mean, my gut feel, I'm not a lawyer, obviously, but my gut feel is that this will probably go nowhere, but it'll be an interesting one to watch.
Yeah, I think you're probably right. I mean, the kind of, you know, small print on your mobile phone account, I am sure has, you know, lots of, you know, finely lawyer crafted words that mean you can't sue your telco for this kind of thing. But yeah, I mean, it's good just to kind of, you know, make it somebody else's problem for a little while. I mean, it'll make the telcos maybe think a little bit about it. And I don't know that this is going to be the thing that fixes this problem. But yeah, you know, it's certainly going to get some attention. And yeah, I mean, clearly it's a thing that people are using in the wild. And, you know, if you've lost $23 million, you may as well give it a go. Try and get a few bucks out of AT&T.
We also saw some interesting arrests while we were on break. This so-called Fin7 crew, they're like a Carbonac crew. They call them a cybercrime unicorn because they've taken down like $1 billion. But we saw some arrests of some Ukrainian nationals, which is a pretty big deal, really, because they were, you know, these guys were pretty much like apex crooks.
Yeah, that Fin7 crew has been doing quite a lot of things, quite a lot of money stealing operations. And they're quite sophisticated as, you know, that kind of cybercrime crew appears to go. Like, they're certainly one of the ones that we've seen discussions where you know, they're hiring actual hackers to do their work, but no one's really clear whether those hackers understand that they're working for a crime syndicate. Like, there's one of the organizations where people have said, oh, well, maybe they're hiring pen testers and not telling them that it's not a legit, you know, authorized operation, which is kind of a, you know, an amusing amusing wrinkle to the story. But yeah, a bunch of people rolled up.
Your deliverable is not a report. It's just the shell, okay?
Yeah. I bet you they'd make them write the report anyway, just out of spite. Damn.
Yeah.
Jerks. But yeah, they got a bunch of them got rounded up, and obviously they're facing a whole bunch of charges. I don't think that this represents the entire operation, but certainly, you know, it's going to take a dent out of this particular crew. The rest of them, I imagine, are, you know, going to take their $1 billion and, you know, go sip a margarita somewhere.
Yeah,
and
well, wait for it unless, all to blow I up. Mean, unless they get flipped on, right? And we're talking 26 felony counts for each of the three charged. So there's a hell of a motivation there. So we'll see where that one goes next. Speaking of people sentenced for cybercrime, some former Microsoft engineer has been dinged for his role in a ransomware scheme. Microsoft had hired him after his involvement in that had finished. And obviously, I doubt they knew. But yeah, he's been sentenced for that. I think he actually got some jail time, didn't he?
Yeah, apparently he got 18 months in prison. It doesn't sound like he was a super big wheel in the operation. He was doing some of the like cashing out money muling bit of the operation. But either way, I'm sure Microsoft were, you know, kind of face palming when this one came up.
Now we've got a really interesting story here from Foreign Policy. This is, you know, more spy stuff than bread and butter infosec stuff, but. You know, we've mentioned a few times this situation where the CIA basically lost its entire, you know, network of informants and assets in China. It looks like that might have been due to a little bit of the cybering, Adam. And it's like you read this story, and if it is true, you just think, oh my God, that was amateur hour on the CIA's behalf.
Yeah, when this story came up several years ago, I think we talked about it on the show at the time, and there was a subsequent arrest of a Chinese agent in the US, and there was some, you know, kind of speculation that the roundup of US assets in China was kind of related to this former CIA officer who then was informing for China. And it turns out that the investigation into this does suggest that he didn't have sufficient access, and maybe there was some other mechanism. And the story on Foreign Policy that we're talking about has, you know, some suggestion that this was due to the communication system used by the CIA to communicate with its assets in China.
But when you read the tea leaves, like if you read this and try to make some reasonable inferences, it looks like what they were doing is using some sort of like web chat thing. And they had a portal for unverified sources that if they gave it up, it shouldn't be a problem. And then they had like a different system, which was for people they worked with regularly. And it turns out the separation between the two was just junk. And I'm guessing it was probably some, you know, hideously insecure PGP app or something. Like that's the way the story scans to me, right? Which is just unbelievable.
Yeah, it is. It is pretty scary to imagine that many people's lives depended on
30,
you know, what
30
was...
people got executed in China as a result of this. Like just to hit it home for the listeners.
Yeah, and there's actually a quote from someone who used to work at the CIA, and he said that the CIA had, quote, f***ed up the firewall, unquote, between the two systems, which, yeah, does suggest kind of a level of coupling at a technical, like technical specific level, and that the Chinese had gained access to one of the kind of systems not used for trusted informants and then escalated that into technical access to the one used for more trusted things. The report also suggests that the system in question was actually developed by CIA for use in the Middle East, where the level of technical surveillance and technical capability, you know, kind of wasn't at the same level as in China. And then it got moved into being used in China without really, you know, enough consideration of, you know, the extent to which the Chinese are very good at spotting and manipulating network traffic traversing the Great Wall of China for covert comms. So, yeah, I mean, it's an interesting
well,
kind of...
Well, the mind-blowing part for me is where they say, yeah, after their sources started getting, you know, blindfolded and shot, they decided to pen test this system and they found some problems. And you're thinking, you do this after?
Yeah, that's not really the recommended order. Normally, you think about testing it first, Mr. CIA. But yeah, I mean, it's a tragic story in several respects, and I guess kind of underscores the importance of getting everything right all the time when you're dealing with when you're dealing with intelligent systems and especially human systems where people are going to die.
Oh, it looks like, possibly Lazarus crew. I don't want to jump to any conclusions here based on incomplete information, but we've seen a cash out theft effect in an Indian bank. We're talking like 11.5 million pulled out of 14,849 ATM transactions across 28 countries in a short period of time. This was followed up with a $2 million transfer via the SWIFT terminals at that bank. That's got to hurt, but this feels a little North Korean, right?
Yeah, I guess old mate Kim Jong-un is going to get himself, a new car or something, whatever you buy with, $12 million that you've nicked. But yeah, it has all the hallmarks of the same sorts of things, attackers that get into the payment systems, into the SWIFT systems, understand enough about how they work, cash up a bunch of cards and then, a whole bunch out through ATMs, simultaneous withdrawals across 28 countries. Like, that is a degree of operational sophistication that,
We've seen straight up criminals do this before, and I don't think we've seen the North Koreans do a cash out before, but it wouldn't surprise me if they're escalating because, cybercrime is their business these days. And, it's just amazing that we've got a nation state that is acting essentially like a financial fraud crew. The only difference being is the authorities can't do much about it because you can't arrest them. They're going to operate.
Yeah, exactly. And if they, if they're committed to funding, a significant portion of their economy through this kind of shenanigans, we're just going to, we're going to keep on seeing it. It makes you wonder how many we don't see, when they're trying to hit their quotas for money stolen from the decadent West.
Yes, or the decadent East, apparently.
Well, in this case, yes.
Well,
I guess.
The DNC CISO Bob Lord has told candidates and staff working for that political party, do not use Huawei or ZTE devices.
Yep, and he says that it's obviously based on the recommendations from the intelligence community in the US. He says that they don't make such recommendations lightly, and perhaps the DNC staffers should pay attention and consider paying a little bit more, even if your ZTE or Huawei device happens to be very low cost or zero cost. Maybe consider something a little more robust.
Now, look, here's a bit of research from Checkpoint that would be easy to dismiss as just whatever, right? It's they've come up with a way to own fax machines over the phone line due to weaknesses in like the fax protocol. But this is a big deal because, I mean, what a beautiful way to get an entry onto a network. No one segments these things. Quite often they're scanners as well and, maybe used to copy and whatever. But what a great way to get a foothold on the network in a way that's not going to get detected.
Yeah, this was a talk at DEF CON and I looked at it on the schedule and went, that's not going to be what I want it to be. Like, I want
it
to be remote.
It totally is.
And then, yeah, it turns out I didn't go to the talk because I thought, it won't be anything good. And then, yeah, I read it afterwards and like, God damn, it actually is exactly what I wanted it to be. You have to click through like 400 layers of Checkpoint marketing to actually find the technical details. But yeah, they did the real thing. They got themselves an HP, like, all-in-one fax printer scanner copier thing. They reverse engineered it, including having to like bodge a JTAG port onto the side of it and then export it locally over the network to like load their debugger to then understand how the fax protocol parser worked. And it turns out that they found a bug in the JPEG handling library. You can faxes over the actual like T31 fax protocol. You can send TIFF data, you can send JPEG data. There's a bunch of kind of different encodings for the digital image data being sent by the fax. One of them is JPEG. They implemented an exploit of a JPEG parsing bug that they found through using IDA on the firmware of this device, and then escalate that into like basically executing the JPEG file as an executable image on the printer, you know, fax machine itself, which, you know, that's pretty cool. Like send a malicious fax. And then not only, I mean, get code exec, then they make it even worse by like loading up Eternal Blue across the fax connection and then using that to shell Windows boxes they find across the LAN to then get their connectivity back out, which is just, you know, that's everything I want from a fax machine exploit. It's a beautiful thing, and they've done good.
Yeah, no, totally. I just think that this one, I haven't seen it really reported many other places, but I'm thinking, because yeah, the same thing. I saw the headline and thought, oh, this is probably lame. And then I read it and I'm like, no, this is not lame. This is like, it's the good stuff, man. It's the good stuff. You can totally use that. Yeah, and people will. So there you go. Now, look, I've seen a few outlets reporting of these on these so-called man in the disk attacks. This is when you get a rogue application onto an Android device and you get a permission for external storage. Then you can start screwing around with other apps data on the external storage and maybe even get code exec. Is that right?
Yeah, that's a fair summary, I guess. It depends on the applications in question that are consuming data from a disk, not correctly validating it, which is kind of against Google's advice for how to write good Android apps. But yeah, that's a basic summary. Yeah, well, yeah, exactly. That's the yeah, well, because even some of Google's own apps apparently do not correctly follow those instructions. And one of the examples they were using was compromising Google Translate, which caches stuff out onto the external storage. I think the suggestion here is that, you know, most people don't think that granting external storage access to an application is particularly risky. But yeah, it turns out that it kind of is.
Yeah, I guess it's just another one to put on the list of, you know, Android issues, yeah?
Yeah, dumb Android things.
Yeah. Now, Bleeping Computer is reporting on this apparently, you know, simplified method for cracking WPA and WPA2 passwords that actually looks like the business.
Yeah, this is some great work by Jen Stubb, who's the developer of the Hashcat GPU password cracking tool. He came up with basically a new way to acquire the kind of cryptographic material that you're going to then offline crack when you're trying to break into WPA2 pre-shared key networks. Historically, if you wanted to do this, you have to capture the exchange of a client authenticating to the access point and get kind of all four frames of the four-way handshake process and then crack those offline.
And now this is just like grab a frame, any frame.
Yeah, and this one essentially in networks that have roaming support turned on, which is, you know, nearly all modern 802.11 networks, you're able to get that data with only one frame. It's not dependent on there being a client on the network. You know, previously, if there were no clients, you couldn't crack a PSK network even if the password was rubbish. So yeah, this is makes it a lot more practical in the real world to actually go and crack networks. It doesn't change the speed of cracking materially, so you still have the same kind of level of complexity, but it makes getting the material to crack a bit more straightforward. So yeah, I think that, you know, is a thing. You know, it will materially change the amount of networks that get owned.
Yep. Now, look, I caught this one being spoken about in a couple of places. There are a couple of BGP hijacks affecting US payment processors. And, you know, everyone's immediate thought is why would they do that, given that that data is likely encrypted? And then I thought, well, you know what? Like, how much of this stuff actually properly validates TLS? That's where I'm kind of at with this. What did you make of this story?
Yeah, I think you're right. I mean, obviously there are plenty of things that you can do with a network connection. You know, not everybody has great TLS support, and we've certainly seen, you know, embedded systems historically as having a pretty rubbish implementation of TLS cert validation. So yeah, it wouldn't be unreasonable to imagine, say, like a bunch of
point of sale systems, payment terminals. Exactly. That's exactly what I thought. And the best they're going to do is pop up a little warning to some retail worker who's just going to go, oh, okay.
Yeah, I mean, if that. And also, I mean, there's still plenty of payment systems that, you know, really are just pretending that you know, the internet is just a serial line and may well not even be crypting things. Maybe all they're relying on, like in Australia and New Zealand, we have a particular standard for doing this kind of payment processing, you know, where there's crypto in the protocol and you don't necessarily have to encrypt the outer layers because, you know, like you don't have to do it over TLS and it would still kind of be okay. But, you know, there are technical vectors, you know, when you're not protecting everything by TLS. So, yeah, there's still plenty of non-TLS transactions going on, and maybe those are what's being targeted rather than the ones that are doing it right.
Andy Greenberg's got a nice little story up here about how fragile power networks are in terms of, like, if an attacker's able to own a whole bunch of people's air conditioners or water heaters or devices, you know, home devices that generally consume a lot of electricity and turn them on all at once, this could be a serious problem for power grids, which, you know, I suppose once you say it out loud, it kind of seems obvious, but it's, you know, it's surprising how few devices you would actually need to own to cause major problems.
Yeah, I mean, obviously, there's a lot of work in the power system to try and forecast demand correctly and deal with, you know, when there's going to be a spike in demand or a drop in demand, you know, because these, you know, power systems do have to be fundamentally in balance so that the amount of power coming in is roughly equal to the amount of power going out, you know, modular or very large array of batteries or something. So, yeah, no, it is definitely a thing to consider attacking it on the demand side instead of the supply side. And, you know, I was walking to work today. There was an ad for, you know, internet-connected IoT air conditioners on the back of the bus that went past me. So it's certainly a thing that we're going to see more of. Of course, reading this, the thing that occurred to me was, so I don't know if this is the case elsewhere in the world, but in New Zealand, we have remote control of electric hot water heating, where the power company can actually send a signal encoded as a high-frequency ripple over the top of the regular power supply to then turn people's hot water on and off to manage, you know, load shedding.
Yeah,
we
got that here as well. And they usually use it as like a peak off-peak signal sort of thing.
Yeah, so I figure this is a thing that's probably done in all sorts of places around the world. Now, attacking that system, if you turn off everybody's hot water, it might save you having to, you know, go do the IoT thing. Maybe you can find, you know, some easier way to do it, you know, hack.
Well, I mean, I like how you just said there might be an easier way to do it than this really easy way that we're just talking about, right?
I think. Yeah, I mean, I suppose, you know, guessing admin to a bunch of IoT devices that you found on Showdown is pretty easy, but I mean, it can't be, you know, that much harder to go hack the ripple control system.
Well, I guess, you know, this is just an idea. I think some of the policy types might have to start thinking about this one because it's not something that I think has been an immediately obvious threat. And, you know, when you sort of think about it for a few minutes, you sort of think, yeah, maybe people need to sit down with a pen and paper, speak to a few experts and see if this actually really is a problem. Because by the sounds of things, it could be. Oh, we got an interesting little bit of research here that was presented at DEF CON. Patrick Wardle has, you know, he's often doing stuff on Mac. He's found, you know, some nice little user warning bypasses for Mac OS.
Yeah, so this is a, you know, kind of a class of attacks where the OS pops up a warning dialog when some, you know, local malicious piece of malware is trying to do something, you know, load a kernel module or something like that, and it will go ahead and attempt to kind of click on the dialog for the user to approve its malicious action. And there's a bunch of mechanisms in place to try and kind of stop that sort of thing, you know, control around the accessibility plumbing, all that kind of thing to detect, you know, synthetic input. He found a couple of bypasses for some of the previous fixes that Apple have put in place for this. You know, some of them are as dumb as sending two mouse down events and then one of them gets turned into a mouse up event by some kind of, you know, debouncer or whatever, and that one is not marked as having come from, you know, a synthetic input and just bypasses the check, you know, that kind of thing. So yeah, if you are writing macOS malware, might be worth having a quick read of his presentation.
There you go. Some NSO group malware has turned up on the phone of some Amnesty International researchers. That's lovely, isn't it? Those guys are not the nicest. What else we got here? Oh, yeah, we got some bad people using vulnerabilities in D-Link modems to, like, redirect people to fake bank sites. I mean, this is, you know, pretty par for the course, usual IoT rubbish hacking stuff, isn't it?
Yeah, I mean, admin, off you go. You know, they've been redirecting, a bunch of banks in Brazil, I think. So perhaps that particular model of D-Link is widespread there. But yeah, it's pretty normal IoT junk hacking, sadly.
Yeah, Tom Fox Brewster at Forbes has written up the IoActive research into, like, airplane Wi-Fi systems, which was really like, you know, okay, you can get man in the middle for, you know, business people using their laptops on airplanes. Didn't, you know, in the civilian context, that research didn't seem that interesting to me, but it could be used for some sort of location-based stuff in the case of military. Mostly, I was just interested in this one because you and I were both in the media room when he was doing the presentation to the media and he had the satellite dish sitting there spinning around. That was pretty cool.
Yeah, it was pretty cool stuff. But, I mean, in terms of actual impact, as you say, I mean, there's no direct connection to the safety systems. In some cases, these were, you know, as once again, as simple as admining your way to the management interface on some of these, like, satellite terminals on planes and boats and that kind of thing. He did suggest in a reasonable stretch of lateral thinking that one of the vectors you could use to weaponize this was to use the dish to direct microwave energy at people, like, on the boat or on the plane and, try and cook them. So, you know, that's kind of novel.
I missed that part, but that's pretty funny. And look, finally, big bit of news for one of our sponsors. Cisco has acquired Duo Security for $2.35 billion, which is a lot of dollars.
It really is a lot of dollars.
Do you think this is to get around their whole default creds problem?
Well, I guess, yes.
Seems an expensive way to fix the problem, but, you know.
Well, I mean, they probably get a lot of default creds, you know, dollars per creds. Maybe it's pretty reasonable, you know.
But, I mean, you know, I mean, that was the talk of Vegas, right? Everyone was asking me because they know that, you know, their sponsor and I have, you know, pretty regular contact with Duo, and people are nervous. They're really worried that Cisco are going to, like, ruin them.
Well, I mean, certainly my, you know, I've got multiple hats to wear at this story, right? I mean, I guess as a, you know, old school hacker kid, it's really great seeing, you know, people like Doug Song and John Oberheide, who are very much our people, you know, being successful in the industry and, you know, making presumably quite a lot of dollars for what has been, you know, a really good piece of work. I mean, Duo is getting paid that much because they are, you know, a very good multi-factor auth solution. And it's a thing that the industry really needed. They picked a niche. They did a very good implementation. They had great service. And, you know, it's nice to see them being successful. But, I mean, also have the, you know, the hat where they sponsor the show, which is very nice of them. Thank you very much for sharing some of your dollars. But then again, I'm also a customer of Duo. And as a customer, you know, I looked at that announcement and went, oh, God, Cisco. Now I have to have a plan for when Cisco inevitably cock it up.
Look, they're making some big changes there. I actually had a sit down with Doug, which was great. Actually, I just sat down and had a bit of a chat to him, and Haroon Mir actually joined us, and I was like, wow, you know, I'm sitting here with some pretty smart people right now. And, you know, we'll see what happens. We'll see what happens because they have made some sort of executive changes recently. The fact that they've spent so big on Duo, I think would make them less, you know, more motivated not to screw it up. And of course, along with Duo, they've just acquired themselves two really effective executives in the form of John and Doug. So I don't know. I mean, I hear your concerns, but I'm not ready to just claim inevitable doom, you know?
Well, I mean, it could have been worse. Like Oracle could have bought them and then we would have known for sure that they were going to make a mess of it. But yeah, I mean, it's, you know, Cisco has made a lot of acquisitions over the years and not all of them have been disastrous. So, I mean, there is certainly some possibility there. But yeah, it's going to be an interesting one to watch and see, you know, kind of at what point, you know, Cisco's nature starts to kind of come to bear.
I know, I'm with you, but it's like, it's harsh. All right, Adam, that's actually it for the week's news. You know, we did plan to have a bit of a discussion about what you saw in Black Hat. We're going to do that as a subsequent recording, and I'll probably post that on Monday so people can keep an eye out for that. Thanks a lot for joining us. We'll chat to you. Thanks a lot for joining us. And yeah, we're going to chat to you about that Black Hat recap. And, you know, there's going to be a lot of metal in the show over the next week.
Yeah, no worries, Pat. I'll talk to you then.
That was Adam Boileau of Insomnia Security there with a look at the security news of the last couple of weeks. I'll be publishing a Black Hat recap podcast early next week, which is just going to be Adam pretty much talking about all the cool stuff he saw in Vegas. But yeah, it is time for this week's sponsor interview now with Casey Ellis, CTO of BugCrowd. And something cool happened at Black Hat. The team behind Burp Suite, PortSwigger, presented some really cool research on web cache poisoning attacks that could be used to do all sorts of fun stuff. And like they have with some other work they've done in the past, they wound up monetizing this research directly by using it to just clean up a whole bunch of bounties. Now, they'd probably do that sort of research anyway because it's relevant to their work on Burp, but the point is this is the second time they've pulled together some very clever research and monetized it by hitting a whole bunch of bounties simultaneously. I suggested to Casey that this is a great unintended consequence of bounties being a thing. Crowdsourced high-value research. But Casey basically says, nope, that's 100% an intended effect of bounties. Here's what he had to say.
I'd actually, you know, kind of contradict that and say that that's exactly how it's intended to work. Like when you think about the reward model. It's the first to find each unique issue, and the more severe the issue, the greater the reward. So what that incentivizes is novelty, like this whole idea of, you know, people going in and actually coming up with stuff that's, you know, never been tried before, or stuff that's like novel research that's going out there for the first time. And then also figuring out all of the places that they can go out and actually find those unique issues first, and then collecting the reward for it. Like that's basically how the game's structured. So to me, like the fact that it's, you know, starting to pop out tools and things like that, that wasn't intended, as you say, but the fact that that is happening is very much a function of the model.
When you say tools, I mean, I know that you're specifically speaking about stuff like Asset Note there, which is, yeah. And we had Shubs on the show talking about that, but that's an asset identification platform that was certainly born of the bug bounty world. Totally. But I can imagine that people sitting in this Port Swigger talk might have gone, geez, you know, we would have missed that one. You know, pen testers would have been sitting there going, oh, crap, you know, we would have missed that 100%. One if that was our client, right?
So yeah, no, definitely. I mean, yeah, it's pretty cool watching all that stuff go down.
Yeah. You know, the reason I say it's sort of unexpected is that, you know, this is a group of people who are already making bank, you know, creating tools, right? So I guess I wasn't quite prepared for the idea that businesses would start doing bug bounty stuff. Does that make sense?
Yeah, no, totally. And, you know, it's, I mean, to me, like watching that all happen, you know, some of it's unintended and some of it's unexpected, but some of it's just logical and sort of makes sense. Like, you know, the Port Swigger guys are super helpful. They're very active within the bug bounty community itself, like helping out and, you know, collaborating with folk and all of that other stuff. And those are the conversations that happen, you know, in private chats and whatever else. So like they're, you know, what's happening is that there's this community of research forming around, and that has really formed at this point around bug bounty hunting.
Have you had many pen test firms doing the same thing? Like they've found some sort of new technique and then they just go and smash all the bug bounties with it?
No, not as much.
Because that's kind of surprising considering that, you know, there's like a lot of money up for grabs if you find something good enough, right?
Yeah, I think you know, the pen test firms still kind of see us as pretty much a like core adversary in the market, which you know, in some ways is true, and in a lot of other ways really isn't. But yeah, I mean, you know, we've had some conversations with smaller firms around the idea of like them using their unique you know, approaches. They might have a certain skill set that they've built around within their firm that, you know, they're thinking, okay, well, how could we apply this to vuln research through a bug bounty program. So, you know, the conversations are happening, but in terms of what happened with Port Swigger and you know, these bugs that they seem to be smashing out year after year, I haven't seen much of that yet.
Yeah. Now, look, you know, we're obviously just back from the shit show that is Black Hat and DEF CON in Las Vegas, you know, marching through the desert wasteland between various events and meetings. Now, you launched a couple of things before heading over. One of them is like, you've called it Bug Crowd University. I'm going to have to tease you a little bit and ask you if that's like the Pons Institute. Is Bug Crowd University along these same lines?
No, actually. Well, I mean, look, you know, from a branding standpoint, yeah, you could kind of nudge it in that direction, I guess. So what's actually happening with Bug Crowd University, we've partnered up with folks like Cal Poly, and there's actually going to be courseware and coursework that's tied with this. There's collaboration that's happening between Bug Crowd and them to basically make their students, you know, smarter through the course of doing like CS and computer science degrees. So it's not total bullshit.
Yeah,
call it Bug Crowd University, but yeah, it's you know, there is a bit of license there for sure.
When can I get my honorary doctorate?
I'll accept that drive. That's fine.
So the idea is what, training actual CS students on this stuff, on bug bounty stuff, or things relevant to bug bounties?
Yeah, that and basically everyone else. Like the thing that we're doing is we're going through like what's happening within the crowd itself is that you've got this like elite group of hunters that, you know, certain companies are shipping around and throwing parties for and all this other stuff. And they're very good at what they do. But when you think about the problem that this is meant to solve, it's not going to be solved by a group of 20 rock stars, right? Like we need a larger group of folk to come in and do the work. So really what the goal of Bug Crowd University is to take the middle tier and even the bottom tier of hunters and move them up. Like how do we level them up? We don't want to make them all into superstars, but how do we, you know, give them skills and give them pathways to kind of the next level of effectiveness. and knowledge in a way that, you know, they maybe wouldn't have had access to in the past. So
that's, I mean, you're taking a stab at a pretty, you know, age old and difficult problem, right? Like, I mean, how are you going to measure the success for that?
Really, I mean, yeah, there's a bunch of different ways that we're measuring it, and that's actually a good point, because we're not just punting at you know, what we need to teach people. We're actually looking at the data of how people, you know, the kinds of submissions and the kinds of things that people, you know, graduate through as they get better as a bug hunter, and using that to inform, you know, the things that we teach folk next. So
I guess, yeah, I mean, you can track upwards trajectory, can't you, in terms of skill set, yeah, because you've got the data.
We've got a lot of data, and we've watched that happen, you know, a lot of times. So that's actually the driving force. You know, it's still a hard problem, as you say, but the fact that we've got that kind of information to build it off, I think, gives us a better shot at being effective at it. And when you think about success, it really comes down to, you know, how many people are really crushing it in the space. Like, they're going out, they're doing their thing, they're getting paid well, they're active, they're helping the internet become more secure. So, yeah.
Yeah. Now, another thing that you're having another crack at is this disclose.io initiative. So this is like an open source vulnerability disclosure project. I think it was kicked off in 2014. And the idea is to come up with like open source safe harbor language, like help people in the disclosure process. And I got to tell you, like, I often get emailed by people who say, look, I found this thing. How do I disclose this with, you know, while A, being taken seriously, and B, not getting sued or arrested? You know, this is another one of those age old problems. Why is this something that is being sort of rebooted 4 years after it initially kicked off?
Yeah, so as you say, like, we started actually working on this and released a version of it back in 2014, and it did get limited pickup. I think the reason that we're rebooting it at this point is, you know, the work of a lady by the name of Amit Elazari. She's done quite a bit around studying this and actually really, you know, surfacing the issue of safe harbor language. You know, when you think about this whole idea of hacking and it being basically contractually authorized against things like CFAA, like, that needs to be in place for a bug hunter or a vulnerability researcher or whatever to actually be legally safe in their work, right? And the same thing applies for DMCA if you're going after cars or medical devices or like stuff that you can pick up and hold in your hands. So, like, the whole idea of it is, okay, how do we, you know, get to the point where there's safe harbor language that's providing safe harbor for both sides of the equation, so for the program owners and for the hunters, right? It's legally complete, but also is, you know, as easy to understand as possible, right?
Yeah. So, I mean, I got one at the moment where someone's identified a information leakage issue, which, you know, I mean, it's almost certain they didn't break any laws by finding this, but the impact is quite severe. And in a place that is sensitive and going to make government very, very nervous. So even though this person is, you know, almost certainly in the clear, you know, I'm trying to give them some advice, and I don't know how they can raise the, you know, blow the whistle on this without having their front door kicked in, you know, to be honest.
That
is a problem.
And that's, yeah. And that's exactly the challenge, is that, like, you know, CFAA in particular, but pretty much, you know, the majority of the anti-hacking laws that exist around the world are written in a way that's so broad that, you know, you just mentioned, oh, they probably didn't break any laws to get that. Well, that's going to be at the interpretation of someone who doesn't really understand technology in the way that we do. Mm. So it's like, okay, how do you, you know, the target and the goal for me and for BugCrowd and really for this project is to make, you know, the creation of a vulnerability disclosure policy as simple as possible for as many organizations as possible, so they can get proactive about actually encouraging this conversation. Yeah.
I mean, sometimes it only takes one person, right? Like, I'm sure you and I, we both know Alex Tilley, who's former Australian Federal Police here. You know, he's no longer with AFP, sadly, is at SecureWorks, which is, you know, as taxpayers, our loss, and as a commercial entity, SecureWorks gain. Okay. But, you know, he was basically a one-man disclosure pipeline here in Australia. He was great. Like, anyone who had this sort of problem, you'd just kick him through to Alex, and he would get in contact with these companies. And of course, you know, when it's the AFP getting in contact, they'd take it seriously. And there would be no question of, you know, he'd say, oh, has this person done anything wrong? He'd be like, well, no. And they'd say, okay, thank you very much. And they'd just go and fix the issue. I mean, that's the thing. Like, why can't we have more people like him?
Yeah. And I think that's going to, I mean, that'll happen over time. Like, you look at, you know, the interesting thing about vulnerable disclosure and bug bounties is the more it gets picked up, the more it'll get picked up. Like there's a kind of a viral snowball-y sort of nature to it, both on the hacker side and on the company side. And yeah, I mean, going back to Disclose.io, the whole idea is, okay, how do we create language that's really easy for people to adopt, that becomes standardized over time, and that, you know, is open source and collaborative. So it's not a bug crowd project. It's like, okay, this is everyone. Let's get people in here to mess around with this thing and make it better, and then see it get adopted by everyone. So,
what's the URL on that one? It's disclose.io, is it? Is that right?
It's disclose.io, which is the you know, basically the landing page that tells you what the project's about, and then that pipes you off to the actual GitHub project, which is where all the action happens.
Wouldn't it be nice if certs actually, you know, did this like they're supposed to?
Oh yeah. Yeah, I mean, yeah, it's, but you know, that's the thing. We actually, it was funny, we talked to, we had a bunch of federal, you know, Australian dignitaries in the office. We were talking about this, and their conversation was, yeah, this is something that we're working on too. And, you know, my response in that conversation was, yeah, but we're gonna go ahead without you guys, because ultimately I think there are certain things where the private sector can actually lead the government and say, yeah, cool, all right, you know what, like, you guys are going to standardize this over time and catch up, and that's fine, because when you do that, there'll be an authority to it that we don't have.
But we're not waiting 4 years.
But we're not going to wait for you. we're going to try to do it anyway. Yeah,
exactly. I think I know who that dignitary was, because you recently had a visit from the Australian Foreign Minister, didn't you?
Yeah, which was quite special. Like, it was... Yeah, it was an amazing conversation with her and her team. I think the fact that, you know, the U.S. equivalent of the Secretary of State wanted to come and visit Bug Crowd, like, that was a trip for me. It was a trip for everyone in the office, and it was a really, you know, it was actually a really good time. We talked about a bunch of different stuff.
Well, she's always struck me as being quite a sharp woman, Julie Bishop.
Very, very. There you go. She's incredibly switched on.
Look, speaking of other notable people that you've had a chat with recently, Elon Musk.
Yeah, that was fun.
He rocked up to DEF CON, and I saw, I think the two people I know who got to have a chat with him was you and Mark Dowd. What did you talk to him about?
Basically, he spent a bunch of time in this particular meeting, and, you know, I got the heads up from a bunch of Tesla employees that we work with, because we've been running their bug bounty program for a number of years now. They're actually the first automotive manufacturer to go out there and do it. So they said, oh, by the way, you really want to be at this place at this particular time, like, wink, wink, nudge, nudge. And I'm like, okay, something's going down. Elon rocked up and basically talked through Tesla's relationship with security researchers. They announced this whole thing that they're going to do now, where if you brick your car while you're performing security research on it, you don't void the warranty. Which is pretty amazing, yeah. When you think about, like, the logistical implications of that, that's a phenomenal move on their part.
Yeah,
and just spent a bunch of time, you know, talking about their support of the hacking community. Talked a bunch about SpaceX and some of their plans there. And you know, when he and I had a quick chat, we were just talking about their program and basically, you know, just reinforcing the fact that, yeah, we actually really value. This community, because we're a bunch of hackers ourselves. That was really the punch of what he was saying, which was cool.
Well, Casey Ellis, thanks for joining us on the show to walk through, you know, some bug bounty stuff, as well as, you know, giving us a rundown on your meetings with dignitaries, private sector and government. It's been great to chat to you, my friend, and we'll chat again soon.
Cheers, Pat.
That was Casey Ellis of Bug Crowd there. Big thanks to him for that. Of course, if you want to run a bug bounty program, do get in touch with Bug Crowd via bugcrowd.com. And that is it for this week's show. We'll be back next week with more security news and analysis, and of course, our special breakout podcast talking about some presentations at Black Hat. But until then, I've been Patrick Gray. Thanks for listening.